Welcome to the Week in Sports Cars on the Marshall Pruitt Podcast, presented by Cooper Tires. Is that Graham Goodwin I hear in a conference room all to himself at Heathrow Airport?
It is, and thank you very, very much, the lovely, lovely ladies in the lounge at Cathay Pacific. I'm on my way to Tokyo tonight via Hong Kong for reasons of economy and getting a half-decent seat and not cramp. But yeah, they've put me into a nice quiet room without a squeaky chair, but with some lovely coffee. So I'm very happy for the next 90 minutes or so.
Not duct tape to the wing. I am glad to see the profits of DailySportsCar.com are up. So all profits good.
Profits either with an F or with a PH. Certainly not present.
Exactly. You wear your robe and grow out your Jesus beard. So look at the benefits that are reaped. So in a normal world, my friend, you would be headed to Japan for WEC. I would be headed to the lovely state of Georgia for Petit Le Mans. As our dear listeners might know, I will not be doing that, taking care of business at home. So a little bit sad, well, more than a little bit sad, that I won't be at Petit. But Racer.com does have one of its oldest, probably its oldest employee, just a true veteran of the game, Andrew Krask, a longtime editor, writer, you name it, back all the way back to the days of On Track magazine, which was a staple of my youth, and he's been a part of Racer since day one. So Krasky, who lived here and I believe Californian and been here his entire life, recently moved out to the East Coast with he and his wife. And so with my unexpected inability to cover Petit, Krasky's coming out of race reporting retirement. So
he's been waiting for that opportunity.
Exactly.
He's just waited till he saw your weak underbelly there, and he's just gone for it.
Exactly.
Vicious. That vicious.
Yellow-bellied Pruitt. And I believe we might have the awesome, also veteran IMSA reporter, David Phillips, who hopefully will be there doing some things. So anyways, let's get rocking and rolling, because we only have about 90 minutes total before they duct tape you to something, a seat, I guess, whatever they're doing inside the plane this time. last week, we kicked off with IMSA, and as we tried last week, Graham, and had, I think, a lot of positive feedback by, instead of bouncing around between series, just being linear, going IMSA, WEC, SRO/GT3, and then fun. Of those four, where do you think we should start this week, my friend?
Well, let's kick off a little bit. There's a lot of questions about IMSA, a hugely popular race meeting, of course, Petit Le Mans, and of course, it's the season finale. But let's kick off with a couple of ACO questions, because there's been some significant news in the lead up to the Fuji race, not least about an equivalence technology change for the Totas, to effectively reel them back in a little. So there's a couple of questions about that, particularly from Jiseki 100, who's asking, Toto have been slowed down for the first time before Fuji by adding 26 kilos of ballast. Is there a possibility Toto being slowed down further if the changes still aren't enough, or is it the maximum the organisers can do? What if a detuning of the hybrid system on the Toto is the only way we can have a fight between Toto and the privateers? Would they allow that? Would it even be possible without requiring massive changes to to the car? That last bit, very pertinent. The reality is that the whole package of those hybrid systems is developed together. So in other words, the output and indeed the big system where you actually harvest the energy that's stored and basically just fired back onto the track. So first things first, there's been a bit of confusion about this. The way the rules are written, Toyota had to agree to a change, particularly to the 26 kilos that's been added. There have been some other changes as well to equalise pit stop times, and to equalise the lap count. But Toyota have to agree to that. And they have to agree to that because what the rules say is that Toyota frees their specification. Now that obviously works in two ways. It works because it means that they can't develop the car, but it equally well means that the race organisers effectively got a sitting target with the Toyotas to work around. The problem is that the non-hybrid cars really have been stretched as far as current credibility and reliability will actually allow them to go. So it's to Toyota's credit that they've said, yes, they apparently, reading a little earlier today, have made it pretty clear they won't be saying yes for Le Mans next year. But for the time being, I think a race earlier than I would have expected this decision to have come, they have said that they will allow that change to be made. Will it be enough? Well, we're expecting a very wet weekend in Fuji, not for the first time for this this fixture. It remains to be seen. But for the time being, it's another move in what's been a pretty fractured season in LMP1 in terms of the way in which the competitiveness of the cars are actually working. Can they do more? Well, you can always add more weight. You can always add more weight, but the reality is, again, that would have to be agreed by Toyota. So let's wait and see how things pan out in the fair country of Japan. Looking forward to that race meeting, as I always do. But it's, you know, it's clearly a sensible thing to try and get better competition. Forget for a moment the points situation. That's a false reading because of the disqualification of both the Toyotas at Silverstone after the issues with the skid block. But it's going to be interesting to see what the colour of the debate is going to be come late Sunday evening, Japanese time.
Let's stick with the general ACO world questions. Jeremy Charette, thank you for sending this back in. And first of all, Graham, my fault. Thank you to everybody on Reddit, Twitter, and Facebook for firing in a bunch of great questions as usual. And as we also try and mention, we do our best to get to as many as we can each week. If we didn't get to yours and you really wanted answered, please resubmit it. It's taken up to 3 resubmissions at times for us to get to things, but we do want you to know that we want to get to them. So if you really are wanting to hear us ramble on, give us more chances and we will try. This is certainly a case of that with Jeremy Charette, who's sending in something that he fired in last week for the first time, Graham, saying, why do you think the Nissan GTR LM program failed? And I can answer that one fairly succinctly. That was the overly ambitious choice of the Toro Track mechanical energy recovery system, Jeremy. They were hoping, well, that car broke ground in just about everywhere possible. Mr. Goodwin and I were read in on that a few months prior to it. But wasn't it right after Petit Le Mans in 2014?
No, it was after the COTA WEC race.
Okay, yeah, it was right after in 2014, 15, 14, I think 14.
14,
yeah.
Yes.
And so we both of us, we flew down to All American Racers in Santa Ana, California, signed non-disclosure agreements, and were shown the entire car by our good man, Paul Ryan, who was handling PR for Nissan, still does, and met with many of the designers, looked at a lot of the drawings, and we were blown away by it. And of the things that stood out to me in that initial just sit-down stage of the information exchange, Graham, was the conversation about the Toro Track mechanical flywheel hybrid system, that what they envisioned being possible combined with the twin turbo V6 Cosworth engine, which was badged as a Nissan, that had they gone for the upper end of what they felt was possible with the Toro Track, they would have had 2000 horsepower.
Correct.
So whatever the number would be on.
Should we just confirm that? 2000 horsepower.
Yeah.
2000.
We would assume the internal combustion engine 500 to 600 of that horsepower. Yep. Picture, maybe a little bit more if they had to push it, but they were initially thinking that they could get something in the range of 1400 horsepower of mechanical energy boost to help propel this thing to 1,000,000 miles an hour. They then came back and said, well, the weight to do that, it was essentially, I think, Graham, they were describing as a, quote, double ERS system. And they said the weight to do that would be a bit of a concern, so they decided to go conservative and stick with the single Toro Track solution, which was, again, meant to put an extra 500, 600-plus horsepower into the mix, if not more, easily matching what the Porsche and Audi and Toyota were making at that time. And the whole problem here is we have a front engine prototype. We have the wide front tires, the skinny rear tires. We have the through-flow aerodynamic design to reduce the overall size of the vehicle as the air meets it. All of these amazing, innovative things, and this overly ambitious, never proven, never done before ERS system is what undid the entire program, Jeremy. So I'll just sum it up very quickly in saying, had it worked, we'd probably be talking about one of the most groundbreaking, amazing, oh my goodness, vehicles ever. Had they gone with a battery-based system, I think we would still be talking about something that was, oh my goodness, how amazing. Had they gone with just a, call it a regular flywheel-based system, sitting in the passenger seat instead of up, you know, sitting up front in the car with this massive, massive piece of metal, we'd still, I think, be talking about this Nissan GT-R LM as a big success. But the choice to build this entire vehicle around a raging, never been done or proven before mechanical ERS system was its ultimate failing. And the other thing I'll add very quickly, because I know we got to move on to other questions, Graham, is I love Ben Bowlby, the car's designer. He is insane, but insane in all the right ways, where our friend Darren Cox, I think, well, he spent a lot of time talking about this program and saying how great it was going to be and innovative and all these things. I know that they didn't have a huge budget. Okay, I understand they did not have a huge budget. It's probably the reason why they did not end up going with an A123 battery-based system or otherwise like Porsche was using and so on. But where I really do see the other element of failure here, not just the choice of the Torque system, but a failure of management, a failure of someone at the very top to say, Ben, boy, oh my goodness, this is crazy what you've drawn up. And so many of these things are amazing. And if everything works, fantastic. But what are the areas that could cripple the program if you're wrong? And to me, even at the time when we saw it, and even just in virtual form, and then also when I was there for its first test run late in December of 2014 or whenever that was, it was very clear right from the outset that that mechanical ERS system was the huge weak link and torpedoed the entire thing. So Ben's job was to come up with big, crazy ideas to try and slay the giant on a small budget. I'd say that he came up with the concept to do that. The fact that there was nobody above him, like a Darren, or maybe someone else to say, my experience tells me this is a big concern. We should probably think less outside the box. That was the second component that I think, well, that was the first component without a set of lanes. And no, we're not going to do that in place. It just pretty much ran amok, and the thing ended up torpedoing the entire program.
I think I'll add just a little bit to this because you're right. It's going to be fairly quick fire this week. That for me, one of my bugbears in the whole of motorsport is there are two ways of doing a program. Way one is with the proper budget and the proper lead-in time and the proper design staff and the proper resources and some wiggle room. Way two is quick and dirty. Quick and dirty is not a bad thing. It just tends to be a little bit more edgy. What you have to have, though, is contingency planning. We've had this discussion before about WEC and about the hybrid manufacturers pulling out. It's happened in other areas of motorsport too. But for me, part of the problem was there wasn't enough of a backup plan. There wasn't a contingency plan in place that would have saved that program from where it ultimately ended up. It is my eternal regret that car was not what it could have been. I'm not going to say should have been, but could have been, because even with the lack of development and pace that that car managed to show at the Le Mans 24 Hours, despite that, it still carried a huge amount of fan favoritism moving forward. There was a real will, a real wish for that to be something that would carry forward and show what they hoped it would be able to do. Very sad, It goes down in history, I'm afraid, of one of the as one of the certainly not the only high profile factory back failures.
Let's stick with another carryover from last week, sent in from our friend Kevin Perez Frederico. Says, I asked this last week, but we'll tweak the question. Is Acura slash HPD interested in a car or an engine supply deal? I know that they express interest in recent years using a detuned version of their 2.2-liter twin-turbo V6 IndyCar engine for endurance purposes. Kevin, honestly, I would need to ask. I have not heard anything about there being a serious interest in developing and running a car or developing and selling whatever this hypercar, car thing ends up being. Nor have I heard anything about alternate purposes for the 2.2-liter twin-turbo V6s after they floated that, whatever that was, Graham, 4, 5, 6 years ago at Le Mans. Mm-hmm. I'll just mention this as a little bit of a wrapper, though, Kev. We have IndyCar's new engine rules coming online in 2021. They're moving to a larger 2.4-liter twin-turbo V6, new everything. So there will be no carryover of blocks or anything else. Could be an interesting time if we're thinking endurance for Honda, at least possibly Chevy as well, to realize that they will have pools of between 50 and 60 of these 2.2-liter motors, Graham, that definitely make pretty darn good power. Wow. 700 plus horsepower in just sprint racing format. What could those possibly do in who knows what kind of vehicles, detuned to maybe 500, 550 to 600? Just thinking out loud here that, boy, LMP3 to I don't know what, but there would potentially be a lot of engines that could be stroked up a little bit or done a lot of things done to them that might be an option for some form of sports car racing if they chose to do so.
Yeah, I think it wouldn't be a surprise if, you know, as things actually emerged, Honda corporately was looking towards another global project. Clearly, an awful lot of the global side of things, the pressure is beginning to come off on their Formula One program, But let's wait and see. Lots to come out in terms of what might happen with LMP1. Should we take an IMSA question?
Well, let's try and get through the entire ACO WEC section, okay, and then move on.
There's a couple of interesting ones. David Faulkner, Asia Le Mans Series, asking, might they include a race at Australia soon, perhaps at the Bend? This new fantastic new track be a great way to include local entries, and bring a hallmark event to the track. I think Australia is on their radar. I obviously work with the Asia Le Mans Series with their TV package. I've certainly been party to discussions about way things will progress in the Asia market for ACO rules racing. They're going to be doing, I think, a lot of careful stepping forward. Remains to be seen whether the proposed Australian LMP3 Championship will be able to get off the ground this year. I wouldn't count out an additional race, whether or not it's a standalone race or whether or not it's a full season Asia Le Mans Series race in Australia at some point in the coming very few years, but certainly not an active plan to do it right now. I'd be fully supportive of it when it's sustainable. We are closing in on announcements of kind of full season grid for the Asia Le Mans Series, which to my mind look like we're going to see double the entries that we saw last year, with some good Australian, European teams coming to play in Asia, with United Autosports, at Career Costs, and others coming across in the prototype and the GT ranks. But if we get to the stage where that becomes sustainable over 2 and 3 seasons, I see absolutely no reason why they shouldn't be looking very carefully at how Australia might figure in regional, Asia-Pacific regional expansion. What else have we got here? We've got Luke, actually, really intelligent question here from Luke Blackman. Will the 4-hour races WEC next season affect the driver lineup for teams? which usually have three full-time drivers. And I know, yet Philip of that says, what will happen with regard to points for the different race durations in 1920 season? Could less points, fewer points be awarded for quicker events? Or how about stage points? Now, that refers to the fact that for Le Mans, and for that matter, for the Sebring race, we will be having additional points awarded there. I have to say, good question, because I've not asked the question. I will ask the question the next time I get the opportunity. It wouldn't be a surprise to me if they didn't, if they just regarded that as being, a kind of flat rate race format. As for the team lineups, I think there's every possibility that we might see some teams opting to rest a third driver for a four-hour race, particularly because when you're in the pro-pro classes, 2 hours beyond the wheel is about right. Whether or not the pro-ams would do that with a different business model, I think is a different question. But might we see some of the pro teams resting a third driver? I think we very well might. Beyond that, though, remember, the GT pro teams, generally speaking now, tend to run two drivers anyway. So reducing two from one, clearly not going to happen. Be with a bit of a tongue in cheek. But as for how this actually all pans out, my guess is we'll start hearing some thoughts on that in the conversations we have with the serious players from now on in. Always assuming, of course, that those serious players come back for the following season.
Now, if I remember correctly, Serious Players was the name of the male strip club that you worked at in your years right out of college.
I thought that was a kind of slightly altruistic IndyCar sponsor. It's different players, yeah.
Very possible. I did tweet out a photo from a commercial that I saw over the weekend for Trumpy Bear. Yes, and it's not a small, cuddly, little, traditional teddy bear one might think of giving a child. It's kind of like our president, an oversized, incredibly far too large personality, far too grand of a thing. Yes, Trumpy Bear, two payments of $19.95 plus shipping and handling. You also get a certificate of authenticity. I'm just saying, it seems like, I don't know I don't know IMSA, but it just seems like Trumpy Bear should definitely have been adorning a hood on something.
Was that a certificate of authenticity for the bear or for the president?
We do know that there were searches for certificates of authentic birth in North America of our last president as commissioned by this president. Can't say if and what this one is, but regardless, we're going to go ahead and leave that well enough alone. Well, believe it or not, we have...
We're more or less there, aren't we?
There's a couple of questions from Enrique Brand. I'll take here. He says, "Guys, what do you think the future holds for GTE? Given almost all participants are switching to mid-engine platforms, are the days for front-engined rear-wheel drive versus rear-engine rear-wheel drive versus mid-engine rear-wheel drive over?" We touched on this a little bit, I think, either last week or the week before, Enrique, with a different question, and I would just say, at least is how I view things, it's almost completely inverted. We don't really have teams switching to mid-engine platforms. We have auto manufacturers who are choosing to take their kind of sort of halo cars, which have become increasingly mid-engined, and replace the front-engine ones they've been using in competition for promotional reasons or R&D, and are just converting to those mid-engined hot rods. Even Porsche, as we all know and love, has taken their rear engine solution and moved that forward quite a bit. So yeah, just to me, it's more reflection of where the state of high-end supercars, hypercars, road car thinking has gone, and that being more and more reflected in what those manufacturers are signing up and taking to the track to compete with. So I'm sure, Graham, that as trends always do, we will see a shift at some point in time to who knows what, but I'm sure there'll be a shift towards something else in the next 5 years, 10 years, you name it. That's one great thing about the automotive industry. It's always moving, and wherever it's at tends to be reflected on the racetrack.
Always looking for the next big thing. It's IMSA time, MB.
What? Well, we actually have a question here that we might start off with. Since Petit Le Mans, which I believe is French for Le Mans with small. No, wait a minute. Or is that a coffee order, possibly? We have a question here. Let's start off our IMSA questions, thanks to Doug Bonham. He says, with Petit Le Mans coming up this weekend, and it being 20 years since the first race, I believe it might be 21, what are some of your best Petit Le Mans memories? We've normally been trying to do one question, one person answering it. This one, I think we might split out to two, though, Graham. What stands out as a favorite or a couple of favorites from Petit for you?
Well, I mean, I can remember my very first visit to Petit Le Mans and being taken around the track to the viewing areas the first time, some fantastic viewing spots for people trackside. But actually, the press room at Road Atlanta, absolutely first class in terms of the view you get, pit in, most of the pit lane, and that epic final turn. And I vividly recall my absolute favorite memory of Petit Le Mans would have been around 2002. Sat down, opened the laptop, was just beginning to get sorted as the cars came out for first free practice, tapping away, looked up, and to my right, a Max Angelelli launching a Cadillac LMP900 car off the inner curb, what looked like about Mach 3, sparks flying everywhere, looked like he was going to come through the window. Good morning, Mr. Goodwin. That just set it off for me. I absolutely love the place. I am one of those guys that wishes I could be in both places this weekend. I can't. I hope everybody that does go to Petit Le Mans gets their own memories this time around. That, for me, that was the starting point live. Lots of others, you know, in terms of mistakes I've made on microphones, was one of the classics there, misidentifying the GTS leading Corvette as what actually was the safety car, thinking they pitted towards the end of the race. One I've not been allowed to forget since. But for me, it's an all-round, stone-cold, world-class event at a world-class track, and in particular, a world-class track for people sitting trackside. There's not too many of those left.
I would also throw in the 2015 overall result, thanks to super extra quadruple downpour and the fact that Michelin was the only tire vendor at the facility with proper rain tires, which allowed GTLM entries to take the overall victory over prototypes because those Michelin wets were just freaking awesome. So that was great. I will, Doug, go back to my number one memory. And I guess there's also a little bit of a plug here. It's not meant to be that way, but it just works out that way. Within the next 24 hours, I will absolutely have a podcast up with our man, Wee Alan McNish, something we captured over the weekend, remembering his 2008 drive of a lifetime, going from crashing, leaving the pits for just the recce lap, to come around slowly and park on the front straight to form the grid. Alan crashing, the repairs causing the team, the Audi Sport team, to go down two laps, and then fighting back over the course of 10 hours to pass the pole winning and leading Peugeot to win the race. Just one of the greatest drives I've ever seen anywhere, period. Certainly the highlight of all of the Petit Le Mans that I've seen in person and also on television. I think I've seen just about all, Graham. I've never seen anything like it. One, granted, he did have teammates in the race. He had Emanuele Pirro and Dindo Capello. They also did great work. Alan in particular, knowing that it was his mistake that sent them two laps down. This was absolute drive of a lifetime. So Alan and I spent about an hour just waxing on about that. He had some hilarious tales to share and also some brilliant insights. And then I remembered, I had a little nugget in the back of my head, Graham, that back in 2008, when I was covering the ALMS full-time for Speed, and we're also doing it in partnership with ALMS, they would send me all of the in-car camera footage on DVDs after the race, plus the entire however long the race was broadcast as well. And so not too long after the race, I had 10 hours of in-car of Alan's drive and cut it down to all the major passes, split into two videos that last about a half hour long. And because I am staring at, no joke, let me count, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13 external hard drives connected to my laptop with just about everything I've ever done ever. I was able, through about four different search keywords, was able to find both of those videos from 2008. So I'm going to spool those up and post those as well within the next 24 hours on my Little Marshall Pruitt YouTube page. So between the podcast with Alan looking back at his 2008 drive of a mistake of a lifetime, followed by a drive of a lifetime, and a couple of the in-car pieces, plus I'm just going to put up some photos too from 2008. Woo, Doug, telling you.
Damn you, Marshall Pruitt. Do you not realize what you've done by my weekend? Do you not realize? I've got to spend hour after hour in a small room with Alan McNish, and I'll be looking at that all weekend, and we'll be told his side of the story ad infinitum.
But think about it. You can say to
it's
him
a chore.
In all honesty and say, Alan, do you remember when you were good? And he can at least look back 10 years ago and cite one example where he wasn't complete garbage. We know the rest of his career.
But he crashed.
Horrific. Complete horrific nonsense from good old Al. All right. Boy, you weren't kidding. We've got a lot of IMSA questions, my friend. And we've got about an hour left before you need to get on an airplane and start flapping your wings. Where shall we go after Doug?
Let's have a quick go with Big Racer Boy. A recent use of retro 911 GT1 liveries by Porsche for Petit Le Mans. What other classic liveries could both you and I see other IMSA teams use? Good range liveries for Corvette, GT4 liveries for Le Mans, etc. That comes from Big Racer Boy. Also, Ian Gent, which retro Porsche livery would you apply to the 911 RSR if you had complete control? Ian says his would be the Jägermeister 962 livery or the 91730 Penske livery. This refers, of course, to the 1998 liveries that have been applied to the Core Autosport run Porsche 911 RSRs for Petit Le Mans. Another surprise from Porsche. Over to you.
Now, Graham, and I apologize if I'm off on the year by a year, but wasn't it one of those 98 Porsches that blew over at Petit Le Mans?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Yes, so it
just
was.
Just want to be sure we've chosen a livery for one of our cars that did not stay earthbound. That was the only thing that stood out to me. They look beautiful, by the way. And I love Earl Bamber's, or Lawrence Ventor's response, gold wheels, when he saw images of it. But how's this? I'll throw this out quickly. While at RenSport reunion and sitting down with Todd Holbert, who's a friend and son of one of my heroes, Al Holbert, we're looking at my laptop, Graham, bunch of photos that I have that I'd set aside of his dad throughout the years. And one of those photos of his dad racing a Porsche 935 at Sebring just caused both Todd and I, just our jaws to drop because of its sheer beauty. I've seen the car in person, actually, within the last couple of years, just, I think, sitting static. I don't know if I've seen it on track, but it is... it was a excuse me, Löwenbräu sponsored, which would have fit Al Holbert's thematic history being sponsored by Löwenbräu with his Porsche 962s. But this was Porsche 935 from Lord, I'm forgetting the exact year, 83 maybe 84 at Sebring, and it was a tone on tone. With the light baby blue Löwenbräu featuring most of the car, number 86, and then the darker stripe of blue, both at the base of the car and then also on top of the fender arches and stuff. That tone-on-tone Löwenbräu Porsche 935 livery with the gold BBS wheels, wheel fan as well. Oh, a very small blip on the Porsche livery radar. There's so many others that would stand out as more iconic because they've been seen more frequently. But I would say that if you can hit the interwebs and look up that number 86 Al Holbert driven Löwenbräu special 935, what it does to one's eyes, it's just big old hearts that you're
1983.
So that would be my choice because it's not a and again, I realize we're talking everything. It's not a Golf. It's not a Martini. It's not a, there's so many liveries that you go, they're great. We've seen them forever. This to me is one of the kind of prime cuts, the B-side livery that I think folks might really, I would enjoy seeing on something there for sure. Let's see. Where shall I take us next, Mr. Goodwin?
I'm going to take you to this one. Russell G asks, and it's one for you. Who is the most interesting third driver on the Petit Le Mans entry list? Names like Nick Jaminet and Chas Mostert have got Russell's attention.
100% Chas Mostert.
Absolutely.
Without question. I've never met him. Been a big fan of his work in the I'm just always going to call it the V8 supercar series, Graham. I'm sorry, I know it's
we should
supercars, blah blah blah, the V8 series. Big fan of his. Love the fact that he got the call up, knowing that we have this conflicting WEC and IMSA weekend. I just can't wait to see that, and knowing that we came close to having Jamie Wincup, all-time great V8 driver who had to cancel when the whole team got scrapped for Monterey. I'm glad that we will still have a V8 driver in the paddock. Wish I could be there to meet him and talk with Chaz, but that's the one who stands out the most to me. I mean, Jaminet has been in, we've seen him before in IMSA. Chaz is the one where I'm like, ooh, and in a BMW coming off the success they've had recently, I think that could be fun.
I've watched him, oddly enough, in Asian Le Mans. He had a season, or most of the season there. Always attended with his dad, lovely bloke. Chaz, straight shooter, but trademark grinding run to break down the resilience of the cars ahead, quite often taking over after the gentleman driver had been aboard the car. Never failed at all to take less than a minute and a half out of the cars ahead. Never. Absolutely outstanding. And I think he's going to just love Petit Le Mans.
Brilliant. Brilliant. Let's see. I will grab one or two here. Let's see. Darth Fracas, that's a great name. Coming from Reddit. Silly question, really, but what are the odds Corvette can convince Kevin Magnussen to race with his dad at Daytona? Has ever been a father-son pairing like that? We do know that Kevin was at Daytona, was it last year for the Roar, I think? I believe it was last year at the Roar. Well, if it was this year, whether it was this year or last year, one of the two. Kevin was at the Roar, super quiet, just there to check out things with his dad. I only learned about it months later when Yan told me about it. I was like, are you kidding me, man? You should have told me. I would have really pestered him. I know that there were talks for him to possibly participate with the Action Express team in a Cadillac DPI. That did not pan out. I don't have any kind of great insight to add here, Mr. Fracas, but I will say that I don't know how many more years Yan will decide to race on a full-time basis. I'm not saying he's going anywhere. It's just saying, you know, he's been doing this for a long time. You're getting to that window where you might consider, are you coming close to saying farewell? My guess would be if and when we get close to that, that might be the trigger for Yan to say, hey, he's been around. I know we've talked about it a little bit. I really want to do something with my kid at an endurance race. And at that standpoint, that would be pretty amazing. Not just for them, Graham, but because Kevin is possibly the most hard-nosed, hard-edged, a-hole behind the steering wheel driver we see in motor racing. He's cleaned up his act a little bit this year, but yeah, you want to talk about someone, even an F1, who's not afraid to feed you a wheel or a wing or a side pod. Imagine him having proper body work that can withstand that for 24 hours or 12 or 10. Yeah, that'd be fun.
Yeah. Going wheel to wheel with someone and beating them over the head with the halo device, that tends to kind of cross the line, doesn't it? You did ask, by the way, whether or not this has happened before. It has, of course, and it happened at Daytona, and it happened in Corvette with the Dale Earnhardt Sr. and Jr. But 2001, was that, MP?
Yeah, I believe it was 2001. Yes, yeah, something along those lines. And it's not Daytona, but we do know, and I believe it's still yet to be formally announced, but we will see father and son Herta here at the upcoming California 8 Hours later this month. And I spoke with Brian a couple days ago, and he said he got yelled at for mentioning that to our friend Shay Adam over the PA system on IMSA radio during the recent IMSA visit to Monterey. But yeah, as the team owner of a Hyundai TCR effort competing in World Challenge, be interesting to see what Father Brian and Son Colton turn up with for the 8 Hour at Monterey. Let's see, where should we go next? All right, fan opinion, our man Baxter, Andrew Baca. Fan opinion about the land penalty at Daytona appears to be mostly that they did nothing wrong and IMSA made the wrong call, while fan opinion is against TDS and in favor of the ECO, despite being broadly similar cases of defeating fuel flow restrictions. Personally, thanks for saying personally, although a hashtag me personally would have been great, Andrew. Personally, I find both modifications to have deserved penalties and think IMSA's prompt action was better than the post-race action by the ACO. What are your opinions on the two incidents, and why do you think fans seem to have the split opinion? If you ruled the world, is there anything you think could be done to create a more unified fan perception of these two incidents? I've rambled on for the last question or two, my friend. Why don't you take this one?
Well, let's start with, I think part of the reason behind the land side of things was the information that was actually put out to the public that the fuel rig had passed tech, had continued to pass tech, and passed, I seem to recall, post-race tech as well, whereas fundamentally that was not the case with the TDS rig. It's a really tricky, you know, it's a great question, Andrew, really, really good question. I think the perception was that the land guys had done everything they possibly could to say effectively, look, this is what we've got. TDS perhaps didn't and just waited for the fault to be found. I think it's a stunningly good question. And you're absolutely right, certainly in terms of the response that that I've seen from fans and, for that matter, people up and down the paddock. I'd add this much in there. I think you have to add in a factor with the TDS side, the G-Drive side in particular. There is a Roman Rusinov factor. Roman, not backwards in coming forwards, and certainly he is a much better winner than he is a loser, should we put it that way, and doesn't hide his emotions, you know, either in the paddock or on TV. And that does rankle with some people. And maybe that's behind this. Maybe the ever-present Roman Rusinov and G-Drive freight train has just put a few backs up and down the paddock, and maybe on the fan, the terraces as well. I've just got that bit to say. I can't explain why, other than perhaps the combination of, you know, Peter Barron and Starworks organization helping out the Monteplaspe by Land Motorsport effort was a more popular entry than perhaps the G Drive racing by TDS was. But they do seem to be remarkably similar infractions.
I'll just throw this in quickly. I think the general feeling or perception, Andrew, might have been a case of, with our G-Drive friends, that there might have been an element of circumventing the rules that was in place. And I know that both penalties and infractions come back to a, as we interpret it, there's nothing saying we couldn't do it, and or we thought that this was a gray area we could exploit. I think the handle-based thing with fuel flow for the G-Drive effort at Le Mans, again, just my own perception, is one that it felt as if there was some intentional chicanery going on here. Having worked with many fuel systems in cars and feeding two cars in my life, this just ticked a box of like, oh, okay, I know what you guys are trying to do. The method you tried to do it was definitely one where you didn't want folks to know what you didn't want folks to know about. With what happened on the land side within the vehicle, I would say that is very much a case of something that is not abnormal. It's something that most teams do, and it, you know, from everything I was told with a little investigative piece that I wrote, they really went like mad trying to improve the refueling time by finding ways to optimize the rate of flow once the fuel reached the tank. I think where things got a little bit sideways and why things were hit with the penalty that they were comes back to the other piece of intel, which was during the roar, when IMSA had fuel flow monitoring electronics in all of the refueling tanks on pit lane, the land one, for whatever reason, was disconnected. So while IMSA was able to gather live data of how long it took for X amount of fuel to go in each car and then work out the flow rate from there, the land was the one vehicle during that test that was not connected, and IMSA did not have the ability to do that. So the first time they saw it happening live was during the race. So I think that's where that question of chicanery, did they just truly forget to connect the wire, the lead to the sensor, or was there an intent to try and hide this advantage from IMSA? Other quick thing too, Graham, this was at the Rolex 24 Daytona for land. Big deal. This was at the 24 Hours of Le Mans for the G-Drive, the TDS effort. Big deal as well. In both, well, I shouldn't say both instances, at least for the land portion, if this happened at the VIR, whatever, you know, a two-hour and 40-minute race, do I think it would have been as draconian of a penalty? No, I don't. I think it's such a big race like this and early in the race like that, that's why IMSA felt that they needed to crack down immediately. So, great question. Great, great opinion, but question as well. Let me roll up here and let's see. Let's see, where should we go? Matt Markland, never being to Petit Le Mans, and that is Le Mans spelled L-E-M-A-N-S. You need to separate the E and the M, Matt, and capitalize the M. What is the reason why that event is so well attended and enjoyed? I'd say that's really simple. Graham spoke about it in relaying his experiences there. It's a beautiful place. It's truly beautiful. You can walk or drive to most vantage points and see some pretty cool and amazing stuff happening. So it's park-like. It's beautiful. It's just fantastic from the racing side. It's also very much of a party. And the folks, most folks going there aren't just there to enjoy 10 hours of competition. It's because they also want to bring the barbecue and they want to have a cookout and they want to drink some beer and they want to cheer their favorite cars and talk to folks walking by and having a little bit of fun. The spirit of Sebring and Green Park, not as crazy, but there's definitely that same kind of feel of, hey, it's a long enough race. It goes from day until night. We get fireworks, so we get all kinds of fun going on. Let's treat this like a real party here, not just a motor race. So I think, Matt, that's the reason why it's really become a destination for folks every year, early part of October. They know they need to get to Road Atlanta because they're going to have a heck of a lot of fun with cars and with friends. Let's see. I'm going to go to Alex Eichmiller next, Graham. With this being the end of the Continental era in IMSA, what impact do you think they have had on sports car racing in the U.S.? Where would we be if they hadn't sponsored the series for so long? Do you have a feel for that, at least from abroad, or do you want me to field this one?
I'll give you a bit of it. I mean, I think the contribution of anybody that is putting sponsorship bucks into motorsport, particularly at that kind of level, and particularly at a point where, you know, this was a great big unknown, the United Sports Car Championship, remember, I think they're to be congratulated for that. Whether or not their racing product was always the best, that's always going to be a question when you've got a spec tire anywhere. But I think any company that puts in the headline efforts to back a major race championship, particularly in a period of transition, deserves everybody's respect. That's all I've got to say about it.
I'll throw this in. Was not always a big fan of Continental's approach. Very stuck in their ways. Also, a lot of ego. When we had the combined American Le Mans Series and Grand Am come together with Continental winning that tire bid, it's a lot of ego there. A lot of, hey, we're old school embedded with NASCAR. It's our way or the highway kind of thing. And I think that softened over the years. And obviously they were involved prior with Grand Am. I think that there was a very positive change in general, their general approach and mindset. And once, again, this is my interpretation, I could be totally wrong, but I felt that once they relaxed a bit and realized that sports car racing, the real heart of it, and the real heart of what was coming in from the American Le Mans side, which they did not have in Grand Am, Graham, then they would not have experienced. Nobody loved Grand Am. There were some, I get that. But nobody showed up to the races. No one cared. It just wasn't a loved product. It might have been that mindset, that kind of battle mindset of like, okay, well, we're here and we got to fight for everything. And, you know, it's a hostile environment. I think it took them a little while to realize that so many of the American Le Mans series, entrants coming in, drivers, personalities, I think once they got a feel for what IMSA could be and that it could be fun and warm, that to me is really in the last 2-3 years, maybe four, around 2015 or so, I think, is really where I felt like Continental started not just giving a lot, but making a pretty serious impact. So to come back to, excuse me, to come back to directly to the question being posed here, I would say that Alex, I think once they warmed up and got a feel for what IMSA had to offer, they really did some great stuff. And I went from being someone who was not a fan, and I was an openly not a fan, to really being impressed by what they do. Alex, the areas where I really saw Continental then take some big strides, and I think do some impressive things, they started investing significantly in TV commercials. That had an impact, I think at least, had a pretty positive impact of linking their efforts in IMSA and sports car racing with national audiences. They also were developing tires that they very proudly said, hey, I forget the number, I think it was 5 drivers or 6 drivers, but, you know, it's Joao Barbosa, and it's this person, Oz Negri, and this person, and that person. These are road tires we've actively developed at the racetrack with our, you know, pro-caliber IMSA drivers. I'd never seen anything like that before. Back in the day, granted, you know, Firestone, Goodyear, very tightly aligned with specific drivers, but this is many decades ago in terms of R&D alignment. That, I thought, was really impressive. I'd probably say the biggest contribution, though, Graham and Alex, that I've seen is their embracing and activation and personality coming through on social media. I would say that of all the things that will come to mind when I refer back to Continental's time in IMSA before handing over the baton to Michelin, it's that, I mean, I'm pretty very close with the folks at Firestone in IndyCar, had been very close to the folks at Michelin for many years. Obviously, Cooper Tires is our sponsor here for the podcast. I've worked with BF Goodrich. I've worked with Toyo. I might be forgetting a couple others. I've worked with a lot of tire brands. At least 3 or 4 or 5 in the era of heavy social media. I haven't seen anyone get it as right, as consistently, as Continental in that space. So you can go from the just general posts that are fun or warm or interesting and such, and then it's down to also investing. Our good friends, who although we give them heck on social media because it's fun, and that's how we have fun and play with each other. It might sometimes be mistaken as hostility, but it's not. But that's our friends at Dinner with Racers, sponsored by their brand, Continental. And through Continental and Continental's investment, we have not only Dinner with Racers, which now has, I think, 100 plus episodes over 3 seasons or however many it is, but we do have this fun personality. And it's just more of them expressing what Continental is as a brand, who they are, how they like to do things, and aligning themselves with Sean Heckman, with Ryan Eversley. You look at the fun stuff they've done, even, you know, rap video with Jordan Taylor and some other drivers, too. Just bringing character to something that, Graham, we don't often see at the tire brand level. I would say just moving forward onto the next question, but also moving forward with this upcoming transition, Michelin will be very seriously challenged to match or exceed anything that has been done in the social media space, simply because Continental, I think, has done such a brilliant job, but also put money behind folks like Ryan and Sean and others to bring those things to life.
I love your description of the brand's personality, that coming out through that activity. That's absolutely perfectly expressed. It's something that lots of corporate entities fail to do, and sometimes fail really miserably. It's a lot of good people work very hard to try to persuade people in suits to show the personality that actually they do have, and it does seem as if that's broken through. With Michelin, though, and there's another great question, segues in beautifully here from Joe Campora. Will we see IMSA open up the prototype category or others to other tyre manufacturers at any point, or will Michelin just be taking over for the foreseeable future as the spec tyre? Knows that Michelin likes competition. Tyre wars for Joe are one of the best things a race series can still have if you can make it work. Super GT says, would love to see IMSA opening things up again. Now, GTLM stays as an open tyre formula, doesn't it?
It does. And I also would be remiss, Graham, if I didn't kind of throw in there that while I'm definitely giving Continental a big thumbs up for embracing social media and supporting folks, I'm also rather fond of Cooper Tires for doing the same, because they have gotten directly behind us, given us zero instruction on what to do, what not to do, and just let us be ourselves. So, I don't mind speaking favorably of other tire brands, because if I didn't, that would be false. But I also feel as if I probably didn't do a good enough job to help folks understand that we get to do this because Cooper says, go for it, man. Have fun. Do what you do. Let us know how we can help promote it. But other than that, just be yourselves and do it.
So you've not got the two big guys from Continental in the Cooper Tires in the room with you like I do every single week.
Now, granted, are those people that other people see, or are those some of your friends you tell us about?
No.
Follow you everywhere, but not everyone else can actually see them.
Say hello, boys. Say hello.
Yeah. Oh, maybe it is. Okay. Yeah.
Maybe it is just me.
Yeah. All right. I see how it is. All right. Sorry. After this little interlude, let's get back to the question.
Michelin, will they open up the prototype formula? I don't think they will. And I don't think in their circumstances beyond that contract that actually they should, because that's not the purpose here, is it? The purpose for them is commercial activation, and I hope much wider activation and talking to the Michelin guys at Sebring, and I'll have a lot more material on that come the end of this season. It's pretty obvious that this is a big commercial deal for them, and they plan on activating that investment, MP. I'm sure you've had the same conversations.
Yeah, I'm actually finishing editing up a story here for the next issue of Racer Magazine, having spoken with Ken Payne, who is the director of competition for Michelin here in the United States. And so, yeah, beyond activation, beyond all that, I do know for a fact that they are absolutely working hard to make sure that their bespoke IMSA solutions are just that. They have welcomed competition all along in GTLM, as you mentioned. Most recently, we had Falcon Tire that was there. I do not know of any other brand looking to come in and challenge them. So I think by default, by being a butt-kicking manufacturer, I think it is just going to end up being three classes, nothing but Michelin, and no real challenge to what they have to offer. But yeah, I think was it last week, Graham, or the week before, where we mentioned they're using the LMP2 tire from the WEC as the model that they're building off of. They're building off of that for IMSA, at least on the prototype front. And actually, I do need to catch up with them to find out what they're thinking on for the GTD solution and whether it will just be going with something off of GTLM or if they have something else in mind for that front.
Yeah, absolutely. There have been no shortage of GT3 product with Michelin down through the years in various series this side of the pond, including Blancpain prior to Pirelli's move over to the sole tyre supplier. We did have a tyre battle in that series for a little wee while. That's gone away with a commercial decision. Otherwise, GT Open as well, with large numbers of GT3 cars. And actually, there's another bit of a mention for Asia Le Mans. We have Michelin tyres on GT3 cars in both Asia Le Mans and in the Michelin Le Mans Cup run with GT3. So there's templates there. Whether or not that's what they're looking for in the US market, you're quite right. We'll wait and see. There's one here that neatly fits across both the major events. Yes, Bonnie Last 47. Hello. Is it possible? It is possible. The tropical storm currently heading for the Florida Panhandle will bring significant rain to Atlanta just in time for the race. How does heavy rain influence race strategies for an endurance race? Well, you know what? Petit Le Mans and the WEC race at Fuji, both races, as you mentioned earlier, and I think I mentioned too, that have been heavily affected by torrential downpours in recent years. We had the race that never was in the WEC back in 2013. Last year, we had Eduardo Freitas and his fine crew in race control doing all they could to squeeze as much racing as possible out of monsoon-type conditions at Fuji. The weather forecast isn't great for this weekend for Japan. And yet, I tend to agree with you that it looks as if you might get similarly moist conditions at Atlanta. MP, you've been on the hard-working side of the wall, not these namby-pamby drivers and the nice warm cockpits, but strategy in the wet.
Yeah, well, there is this really cool thing about sports cars and even Indy cars, and that is, unlike stock cars, we race in the wet. I mean, honestly, there's nothing different about it than going in planning for a dry race. Chassis setup needs are not as well known because, honestly, it's fairly rare when you get to have a full test day in the wet and to perfect your wet racing setup. So that's the only area where there's more variables. You're more prone to miss the setup at the start of a wet race, especially when if it stays wet, that's great because then at each subsequent stop, it could be small tuning changes made to the car, aero-wise or otherwise. But that's about the only variable. I mean, after that, racing on rain tires at a sports car event, it happens a lot. So just strategy-wise, I mean, there are some practical things. Most drivers in a fully pro lineup, Graham, as we would expect, are very, very good in the dry. Not every driver is excellent in the wet. That might be the only place where you have to have some honest conversations about, hey, I know you can do the job, but if it were dry, you'd be in the car an equal share. Since it's wet, we know that one of your teammates or two of your teammates are stars, and we are going to let them do most of the heavy lifting. That might be the only area I can think of where something out of the norm was needed strategy-wise going into a wet event. Let me grab a couple here that jump out. Ryan, I love this question. Ryan Casillas, with supposedly more P2 cars coming to IMSA next year, do you see IMSA running a prototype-only race like they do for the GT cars at Lime Rock and VIR? Not in time for next year, Ryan. We have a schedule in place already. But that's a seed that I need to plant with the series, at least to think about for 2020. If the car counts do continue to head in that direction.
Put the LMP3s in. Put the LMP3s in with them.
Oh, just because you want to see
that'd be
calamity and hilariousness. I could see something like that. Yeah, I could absolutely see something like that, Ryan. That's brilliant. Another one here from our pal Jerry Sudduth, who says, if Ford falls short of the GTLM title, in spite of winning at Daytona and in spite of the impressive streak this summer, would you consider their IMSA season a failure? And he said, asking as a concerned Ford fan. Well, Jerry, if you pop over to thedelightfulracer.com, I don't know how it turned into 2,000 words, Graham. I really don't. But across Monday, I spent a lot of time writing about all of the most pertinent championship scenarios across all three classes that are running this weekend at Petit Le Mans. All three still need to be settled in terms of championships for drivers, teams, and manufacturer titles. And I'll just go ahead. Granted, please go read it. All clicks are good clicks, Jerry. But I will read this one line that answers your question in GTLM. On the manufacturer's front, Ford will win the title by taking the start. So how's this? If they don't win the manufacturer's title, Jerry, it'll mean that the cars were stolen Friday night out of the transporter and they could not physically take the start. Other than that, provided a Ford GT rolls across the start-finish line with the green flag waving at the beginning of the race at 11:05 Eastern Saturday morning, it's a done deal. So Blue Oval, manufacturer's champ, just got across at start-finish line. Let's see, where shall we go? All right, let's take this one as well from Tom Pendergrass and realize that we've got about 25 minutes left, a real 25 minutes left, not a Pruitt 25 minutes left, which is about 3 hours. Thomas says...
We'll take this one and then we'll go into our general questions. I've got a couple I want to pull out from there.
Absolutely. And stop pulling stuff out. You're at an airport. Good one.
Absolutely.
Come on, man. He says, do you think it's possible that having a severely tilted driver lineup actually helped the core Autosport team stay in the championship hunt? It seemed that there were a lot of races where Colin Brown was charging through the field in the last stint in the only car that was without damage, since most of the field had been running close to each other for most of the race and had some form of contact. Having a slower driver start the race, keeping it out of most of the mayhem going on in the prototype class, again, seemed like it might have been an advantage. I hadn't really thought about that one, Thomas. At least my initial reaction would be no. Knowing that the majority of contact takes place when we have a faster car trying to take a corner and the slower car not seeing it, recognizing that pass is happening late and or just trying to fight it off. Most of the stuff in terms of car-to-car contact takes place in a wedge-like scenario. There is your corner. The slower car that is ahead has started to turn in. The faster car tries to sneak in and get on the inside, whether it's left or right, at the apex and get by. And we usually see some sort of miscommunication happening there. I would say that in this instance, having John Bennett, who is very good for an amateur driver in a fast prototype, just staying clean, I would say he's done an excellent job this year avoiding a lot of scenarios where things could have gone wrong. Then with Colin, I just look at the sheer number of passes he's had to make that might be categorized, Graham, as low risk or, oh my goodness, what is going on here? and getting through them cleanly. So maybe we put that down to Colin being very smart as well. We've also seen that when he does get up to the prototypes and or gets in front, he runs, you know, they've been able to run away due, by and large, not just talent, but BOP, Graham. So, you know, if he were in a Cadillac, I think we would have seen a lot more contact this year, because there have been many, many races where the Cadillacs, for example, have been pegged back due to BOP, and they are truly just side-by-side bristling and hitting and banging, if not themselves, other cars, but essentially locked in similar real estate due to BOP. When I think of the charges taking place this year, especially with Colin behind the wheel, Thomas, I think of a driver in a car that had an advantage and therefore was not locked into the same real estate, therefore banging and losing bodywork. So I think there might have been a few more dynamics at play than just John Bennett falling behind being the thing that let Colin streak forward cleanly.
Hugely intelligent response to a hugely intelligent question, by the way, but I will beg to differ slightly. I think it does take the pressure out from the non-professional driver by allowing them to start the race, where you could expect that there's going to be more potential at the start of a race for trouble that's going to burn some of that time, and therefore less of an impact in terms of the overall pace. It means that John's role basically is quite right to stay out of trouble, but stay on the lead lap. It's to manage that loss of pace against the epic driver squads you've got in the leading cars. But it's been a fascinating season, and it's going to be particularly fascinating to see how this one pans out.
All right, my friend. Well, let me just scroll quickly through the remaining IMSA questions to make sure we don't miss out on any of the, oh my goodness, we gotta answer. I think we're free and clear. We got some ACO world stuff that we covered at the beginning, which is great. We got IMSA taken care of. We're left with a bit of SRO world, general questions, and some fun to wind
up. Let's get it stuck in. And a bit of guidance, by the way, if you're sending us questions, the really, really long ones are really tough to get through in a podcast thing. So try. There's one about a Can-Am suggestion. It's just too long for me to read on air. I'm delighted to come to it next time around, but see if you can condense it down a little bit. But we're going to go with another man who is not a fan of a concise question, Ryan Terpstra. Congratulations, Ryan says to Craig Lowndes. He wanted Shane Van Gisbergen, by the look of it, to win at Bathurst last weekend. By the way, an extraordinary thing last weekend. Two major endurance races, the SIC 888 race, the 888-kilometre race at Shanghai, and the Bathurst 1000, both of which were won by car 888. How about that? Anyway, he asked the question, please feel free to change the name to Protect the Guilty. What colouring outside the lines, bent or broken rules, creative solutions to problems have you heard about that you can share? Huge fan, the race of the fastest car, the race to cross the finish line first. I'll add one quote. There's a famous one that goes back to Jaguar days in the 50s about the starting motor being cooled down by putting it in the bucket of water in front of, because you're not allowed to change the starter motor, and the pit lane marshals missing the fact there was a completely new starter motor at the bottom of the bucket of water, replacing the broken one. But my favourite one concerns a team. I will not tell you who it is at the moment. It was an entry in the Le Mans 24 Hours, which was particularly off the pace, and was not going to get through qualifying anywhere close to the required pace. And somehow, in the dead of night, because of course we qualify through to midnight at Le Mans 24 Hours, in she comes with a lap time a full 7 seconds quicker than it had managed before, and more than squeaking in. Allegedly, by some means, that car either had the electronic device that triggers the timing beam outside the car, or had a duplicate, and that time was completed not by the car crossing the timing beam, but by a team member walking past it.
Yes.
That's the one for me. I know who it was. I know who told me that. They were involved with the team. I'm still yet to get a particularly good reason why that wasn't spotted elsewhere. But that's a thing, and that has happened in relatively recent time. So that's the one for me, MP. I don't know if you've got any to mind.
Oh, yeah. Well, I can add to that, and if you read the great book about March engineering, there's a wonderful tale that's almost identical to that. It might have actually been the inspiration for it. Back in the 70s, in terms of timing and scoring, they would use a light beam and a car breaking that light beam and using that as the method to monitor lap times. And there was still a bit of a manual intervention of, you know, let's say car number one went by and broke the beam. That would produce a timestamp. The person in timing and scoring would write down as car number one. Car number one would come back through again, break the light beam. They would write that down. Car number one again. There's your actual lap time. The time from when it broke the beam the first time to it broke the beam the second time, and so on. So it's just a case of logging, breaking the light beam with the car that did it, et cetera, et cetera. Well, the March team had figured that out, and it didn't have to be a car that broke the beam. So they got caught eventually, but what they would do is they would have their signboard person stand out on the pit wall right next to that light beam. And so when their whichever car it was coming down the front straight, getting close to completing the lap, they would swing out the pit board to, quote, show their driver the lap time. Well, if they happened to trip the light beam with the signboard a few seconds before the car showed up, well, the person writing it down was logging that car as having crossed the beam. So they were manipulating the timing as well in that case. The one that stands out to me in sports cars, and I only learned about this a couple of years ago, if we think back to the highly underwhelming, underperforming Jaguar America Le Mans Series GT2 effort that also went over to France to compete at the 24 Hours of Le Mans. That team, which was facilitated by a certain team that is now running a team in GTD, they seem to take some good money from Jaguar. Didn't necessarily produce the performance that was expected, until they came up with a great way to manipulate opening the back of the airbox. And having heard about the method that what they were doing, well, keep in mind that with air restrictors in place to try and balance the field, you obviously are regulating how much air is getting into the motor, therefore how much power it can make. Well, they had come up with a series of levers through things that a driver might manipulate while in the cockpit. Hey, I'm going to adjust an anti-roll bar. I'm going to adjust a brake bias. I won't get into specifics here, Ryan, but they had worked up a series of levers and cables where doing things on the in-car camera, where if it was spotted by the series, would look like the driver is doing something completely normal. The only thing that might have piqued their interest was noticing that whenever the Jaguars came on to a long straight, a driver would make one specific adjustment, and when they got to the end of the straight, they would make a reverse adjustment. and it was just simply a case of popping open the back of the air box to allow free flow air into the motor, and it made a whole heck a bunch of straight line speed. And the other, so that straight line speed was seen on the timing and scoring data, the trap speeds. But curiously, Graham, despite air restrictor changes and other changes to try and get some of that straight line speed under control, they were never successful in doing that. So I wonder why. A little bit of tomfoolery there.
It's a good one from Robert Northway. Loves both our work.
Bad. We appreciate your bad decision making.
Absolutely. Who in any paddock in motorsport is the most likely, the most misunderstood, I think, is the question here. Driver, team owner, isn't liked very much by the fans, but is actually a great human being, current or in the past. They're all hateful, all of them.
They, for the most part, they are loathsome characters.
Oh, just terrible.
You know, I mention him a lot here, and I don't know, maybe I have a thing, or maybe it's just because he's such an easy character to cite, but I might mention Montoya, Juan Pablo Montoya, as someone who I think is not, who is thought of as aloof or, I don't know, many things that would be considered unsavory or deficient in character. As I've said before, I love the guy. He and I have a great relationship and routinely take the piss out of each other. He's just a blast. He's half insane. He's all kinds of great and funny things. I just don't know if that comes across to the average fan who listens to an interview or sees him on TV, Graham, and gets a lot of, meh, it is what it is.
Yeah.
Or, okay, well, yeah, so what?
I'm gonna have my tenpenny theory, and it's Christoph Bouchy. No. Christoph,
people don't like Christoph. Him enough.
No. People have the opinion that Christoph is loathsome, opinionated, arrogant, and it's all true.
Okay, there's accuracy and truth in reporting right there. I'm trying to think who else. Let's see. Probably, I'd throw Peter Barron in there. You mentioned him earlier. Peter Barron might be someone that many people don't get. Wayne Taylor's probably one of them, and I'm just picking from North America here. Some folks who have whatever reputations attached to them.
Well, here's one that for many years got really horrible kind of fan reaction. That was Wolfgang Ulrich. Wolfgang was horribly misunderstood for very many years because there's that Teutonic, Germanic kind of controlled approach, but a stunning human being, Wolfgang Ulrich, but wasn't necessarily for many, until quite recently, in fact, was not a fan favorite at all. It was only, I think, once you got the days of Peugeot stepping up and actually being able to show that sporting side of his character, which frankly wasn't always that necessary. He was pounding various privateer efforts into the tarmac, but the reality, when you compared it with the kind of the up and coming, you know, we're coming to take you on attitude from Peugeot, was that you saw the best of him. And that was, for me, that was a turnaround in terms of the public persona.
I'd throw Chip Ganassi in there as well. He might have the greatest stigma attached to him, just as being very misunderstood, he's not the warmest person in the world at all times externally, but you speak with folks that work with him directly, and for the most part, they absolutely love him. So that he might fit that as well. Let's take one here from Steve Kowalczyk. Disney calls to offer you guys roles as racing journalists in the next Cars movie. What kind of car do you want to be? And what kind of car do you think they would make you?
Minivan.
But what kind? What kind?
It'd be a Ford.
Oh, okay.
It'd be a Ford. But it would be a well-specced Ford.
Like the old F1 Eurovan kind of silhouette thing? Or what are you thinking?
I think for me, I'm a very analog sort of person. Very analog. So it'd be something slow. Yeah.
See, I was going to say, in my mind, I'd like to think I'm a 1965 Lotus Elan. I know that I'm not. So I would probably say, Steve, a 1986 Saab 9000 Turbo.
Ooh, one of those.
Yeah, well, I'm the son of a Saab mechanic. Well, British and Swedish specialist, but, you know, the latter years of my dad's life, Park Road Saab service was the family business. It's large and cavernous, so that fits me. It also set endurance records back when it was launched for, I think it was 24 straight hours or whatever. I forget how many miles it went, but just keeps going. Got a bit of power behind it. Not the fastest thing in the world, but, got a little bit of muscle. Big, can carry a lot of things. It's also something I'm usually laden down with 100 pounds of crap out in the field. So I think a Saab 9000 Turbo plus... I could work on myself. I could do all my own maintenance, having done it back in the day. So that would be me. It'd be the saddest character, Steve, as well. But we'll go with MP as the Saab 9000 Turbo. All right, Graham Goodwin, we're down to about 7 or 8 minutes. I'm going to, since you're the one having to duct tape yourself to a plane, I'm going to let you pick the final ones to close us out.
Let's go with James Counter. What is the most hilarious crash near miss you've seen? I'm still laughing at Super GT leaders tripping over the Prius Intervention vehicle on the racing line through a chicane under green flag last time out. I don't tend to find them funny. At times afterwards, when the dust has settled, there are those moments. I'm thinking here about Thomas Enger at Paul Ricard with the effective shakedown test with the very early Loader Aston Martins and writing the car off on its first flying lap, and then being forced by the team to come to a formal dinner that evening where he thought he was going to be fired. He was horribly bruised and uncomfortable in every single way. I still got a scrap of golf liveried carbon fiber on my desk from that incident. And it was Thomas being Thomas, an extraordinary individual. Lovely, lovely guy. And it was just the torture that David Richards and George Howard Chappell put him through to effectively punish him for that misdemeanor was sort of wryly amusing. And I've laughed about it with Thomas since then. We've had, a brand new Lister Storm GT1 written off by being rolled at Brands Hatch by its owner on its first lap ever. Didn't complete the first lap ever. A guy by the name of Jake Ulrich got it wrong, coming through clearways, and Barra rolled the damn thing into the gravel trap and wrote the car off. It's those farcical ones when the guy walks away and the only damage is to, in this case, Jake's pocketbook, but in the case of the Lola, somebody else's, that actually you can go and think, you know, there is at least a funny side to that. We've all seen the farcical ones, the Takayanui being run over by the safety car.
I got to admit, I am not happy with that pace car driver. Only did half the job.
Didn't reverse back over him, you mean?
No, that guy
But it's things like, you know, it's the farce when we had a year in British GT where I was covering the thing for the full season. I think I'm right that in the first 7 races, we had safety car intervention in the first 7 races, and not once did they pick up the leader. Not once. And it just got to the point where it was just laugh out loud funny at their inability to do so. So, yeah, you know, it's the human factor comes into these things. But you know, for me, as long as no one's hurt, and as long as actually, you know, I've been tortured by others about my own inadequacies many, many times. And I will tell you right now, I do have a bit of a reputation for being a bit of a Mickey taker in those circumstances. And I usually get away with it by getting punched in the face.
Another one of your stripper names, Mickey Taker, very popular Mickey back in the
Taker.
Day. Graham is still pulling out dollar bills from unspeakable places. So, all right, 6 minutes and counting, Goodwin.
Let's go with a Shea Adam one to finish this time.
I've got one after Shea, then. I'll save one as our closing quote question. But, yeah, why don't you grab Shea?
Not a problem. Let's say... A manufacturer of our choice decides to enlist our driving talents. Oh, yeah. They'll give you one driver to get you physically ready for the task, another person you're choosing from the paddock who will train alongside you. Who do you choose for each position? P.S. They say in Canada you don't need to outrun a bear. You just need a slower friend. Right. Who would I like to train alongside? And who... would get me physically ready for the task. You're going to need somebody that's got a sense of humor, I think, from my point of view. I want someone who's focused. I'm thinking Alex Brundle. Alex has got that focus that I like. He's got good humor to go with it. To train alongside me, someone who's going to make me look good. Really, really good. So it's going to have to be some dog slow gentleman driver. No names, no pack drill. Dog slow gentleman driver. Alex the Terrier Brundle.
I like that one. Let's see. To train me, I've actually been thinking about this for a while. I just need to make the call. I need to call Jim Leo, who runs Pit Fit in Indianapolis, which has become really the preeminent driver, even pit crew training facility. Yeah, I think Jim would whip me into a better shape than the shape I'm in right now. Training partner? I don't know about that. I'm just trying to think of the slower friend analogy here. I'll just go back to 2008 at the Bedford Aerodrome with Aston Martin, where it was myself, John Hindoff, and Sam Collins in GT4 Aston Martin Vantages, and we had a little race or timed attack type thing, and Hindy, who was somewhat humble about it, was second. Sam, who had been talking all kinds of mad nonsense about his Formula V driving days and how good he was a solid third. So I would say that it would probably be my man Steamship Collins, good old Sam Collins of Race Car Engineering. Anything involving going back up against Sam, even in my current more portly state, I'm confident that I could wax him like I did the last time. So that would be my choice, just because making Sam, you know, cringe. Oh, it's a delight. Oh, it's fun.
Even at a risk of missing my plane, I'm going to pass on my Sam Collins story because I beat him too. We had an event up in Sunderland, oddly enough, John Hindoff's birthplace.
Is that what we should call a little drummer boy, since we apparently have both beaten him like a drum? I like that.
I kicked his ass thoroughly in a 0-60 competition in Nissan GTR.
Well,
and he made excuses for the rest of the day about how there was no skill involved in it. Yeah, but I still beat you.
Yeah.
So there you go.
Losing, definite skill in losing, Sam. So,
no more Steamship Collins. It's Sam, two-time loser Collins.
Yes,
at this point.
Yes, little drummer boy. All right,
you got one to finish with.
Yep, and it's a quick one, and it's not so much a question, but maybe we should come clean and confirm this. This comes in from Lance Snyder, and Lance, I would just say that your sources are impeccable. I heard Zach Brown is going to be running Fernando Alonso in a B-spec car at the SCCA runoffs at VIR next year, using water as coolant collected from the hydrogen LMP exhausts. Is this true? Breaking exclusive scoop. Hashtag breaking exclusive scoop. Lance Snyder, you are correct. You heard it here first on Marshall Pruitt and Graham Goodwin's Sports Car 342 that Zach Brown is running Fernando Alonso in a 97 horsepower Mazda 12 in the SCC runoffs at VIR using hydrogen collected, water collected from the exhaust of hydrogen LMP2s. So if you want to check out all of our further hashtag breaking exclusive scoops at Marshall Pruitt and Graham Goodwin's sportscar342.com, that is where you can get all.
Well, the sound you can hear in the background is me packing away the cables. I am running, and we'll be back with you next week after Petit Le Mans is done and Fuji is done. I'm hopefully around the normal sort of time for this. I'll be on my way back overnight Monday from Fuji, and by then the dust will have settled, the rain will have drained, we hope, and we can be back for another, we hope, 90 minutes of fun and games. Keep sending those questions in. The couple of you, and you know who you are, who sends us in questions that wouldn't fit neatly onto a sheet of A4 paper, think about how that might actually be just condensed just a little, and we will get to them. This shorter format for the moment, for reasons we all know about, it makes it difficult to get the longer ones in. For now, I'm going to run. And you can wrap it up, MP.
Yes, and next week, the first person to send in a question using haiku will have it read first. Okay, I'm Marshall Pruitt. That is Graham Goodwin. Thank you for listening to The Week in Sports Cars on this little podcast presented by Cooper Tires.